Welcome to Unpacking the Digital Shelf, where we explore brand manufacturing in the digital age.
Hi, Peter from the Digital Shelf Institute here. For online grocery to be profitable and be a better experience, the costs and efficiencies of pick and pack must come down. Well, it turns out the answer is robots. John Lert, co-founder and CEO of Alert Innovation, joins Rob and me to discuss the automation of grocery stores at scale. So John, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I can tell you with the utmost confidence, Rob and I have been so excited to talk to you about robots. I can't even contain
robots.
It's always, whenever we talk about this podcast and we would email about it, robots was always in capital letters with multiple exclamation points. So, and one of the reasons that we wanted to talk to you, of course, and it came out actually in an article that I saw from July 23rd in the Financial Times, Jonathan Ely and Ryan McMorrow. The headline was "Why Supermarkets Are Struggling to Profit from the Online Grocery Boom." The chief executive at J. Sainsbury's, Simon Roberts, said COVID-19 was moving sales out of our most profitable convenience channel and driving a huge step up in online grocery participation, our least profitable channel. And I think, you know, just having talked to you before and reading your site, of course, it looks like a lot of that has to do with the picking of groceries. And so tell us a bit just about your background, about Alphabot, which I'm super excited to hear about, and Alert Innovation. Tell me a little bit about sort of the industry that you meet, the problem that you're trying to solve. We'd love to hear about it.
I'll tell you a little bit about my background first, which is largely the company's background and history. I'm an inventor. Inventors look for problems to solve. And in the mid-90s, I became very interested in supermarket retailing as an opportunity for innovation. I saw that this was a very large-scale business, very complex. All the processes that go on in a supermarket are very complicated, operating at high volume, low margins, and basically very much the way they operated for the past 100 years, not a whole lot of penetration by technology advances and operating model through technology. And so I started thinking, how could you innovate in supermarket retailing? How could you reinvent the supermarket? And I started imagining a supermarket where machines picked all the packaged goods that customers pick in the center store, but customers still have the opportunity for selecting their own fresh products. In the current model, it's in the perimeter of the store. And I got really fascinated in that as an opportunity to both create a superior customer experience and also improve the operating profitability for the retailers. So I started studying automation and very quickly realized that there was no possible way to do that with the current technology. And that got me interested in the automation business or the automation technology as a means to innovate supermarkets. And I started focusing on mobile robotics in the early 21st century. So around 2001, I started thinking that cranes and conveyors could never do it, but mobile robots could. And this was just before the first one-dimensional shuttle came on. So in 2002, Knapp came out with their shuttle, and I looked at that and said, okay, little linear robot, still got lifts, still got conveyors, still too complex to automate a supermarket. I kept pushing. So in 2005, I invented the first two-dimensional shuttle and got investment from C&S Wholesale Grocers to develop that technology for picking cases to supply distribution centers. And we developed that technology, still in existence, still the state of the art in case picking to replenish distribution centers. Sold my interest in that company, went back to work on automating the supermarket, and concluded that even the 2D shuttle would not be sufficient in capability to automate a supermarket and automate the center store. This is a really hard problem to solve in automation. So I started working on a 3D shuttle where the robot could move vertically. And I partnered with Bill Fosnight in 2014. In 2015, we invented Alphabot largely as it exists today, got an animation showing that concept in January and had my first meeting with Walmart in February. And Walmart, to my knowledge, is the first retailer that actually to realize that the only way to be profitable in online grocery is to automate fulfillment at store level. Mm-hmm. But when Walmart was looking to automate fulfillment of online orders at customer level, and we met, and they really responded to our concept animation for Alphabot, and we partnered to develop Alphabot and bring it to market so that we could automate automate store online fulfillment of online orders at store level. That concept has now come to be called micro-fulfillment. At the time, that term didn't exist. I think that terminology became used in around 2018 or 2017. But that's the idea, is to build a small automation system that can be installed adjacent to a store, attached to a store, inside the store, that can automate. And it's also often used for small automation systems that are separate or freestanding. So that would be a dark store or a larger scale customer fulfillment center. Those are very different models in our view. So we believe that retailers absolutely have to automate the fulfillment at store level in order to be profitable online. That was the original premise of our project with Walmart. And
you know what's so interesting about this is I think, I forget the exact date, but didn't Piggly Wiggly, and maybe about 100 years ago, sometime around 1920, give or take, invent the self-service grocery store?
Clarence Saunders invented the first self-service store, and he called it Piggly Wiggly for reasons nobody really ever came to know. And that was the first successful self-service. There had been other attempts, but they failed because of theft. And Saunders' innovation was to use the turnstile. That was the first indoor use of a turnstile. So he used a turnstile to control entry and to control exit, and that's how he prevented shoplifting and made that format viable. And then that changed retail because it was a much lower cost model, more profitable for the retailer, but also it was a better customer experience. Customers liked interacting with products and seeing prices and having all that information. And a very similar thing is happening now, that what we're actually doing,
but in reverse,
it's back to the future. What we're doing is, that was a change from clerk service, and what we're doing is automating clerk service. So we now have, instead of clerks going and fetching the orders for customers, we now have the robots fetching the orders for customers. So it's back to the future with automated clerk service. But what's interesting about Clarence Saunders is he was the first, as far as I know, the first inventor to start thinking about automating the supermarket, because he came to realize that his self-service model created this huge bottleneck at checkout that he hated. And so he wanted to get rid of the checkout. So he started thinking, he was the first, you go back in the early patents, his original thought on what he called Keydoozle, the key does it all, was the first attempt at an automated supermarket. So it's a very interesting history of self-service to automated service. And now, so sometimes I think I'm channeling Clarence Saunders, but that's the idea, is to eliminate the need for customers to have to walk around the aisles, give them a much more convenient and information-rich customer experience when they're doing their shopping, and let the robots do the menial task of actually picking the order. So anyway, so that was my vision. We partnered with Walmart to bring Alphabot to market, and now we have Alphabot operating inside a super center in Salem, New Hampshire, and we're planning additional rollouts with them.
One thing that's so interesting about that back to the future mode, where people for the last maybe 20 years now have been talking about, in some way, shape, or form, the death of the center aisle in grocery stores due to the rise of e-commerce. And, you know, in 2005, it seemed like a pipe dream, 100 years away. And now, of course, in the COVID world, it seems like it might be right on top of us, where they can do more effective work with that center aisle, especially if they can automate it. There's an interesting impact that Saunders' original self-service checkout invention had, which was the rise of the in-store marketing, where all of a sudden you've got the end caps and you've got a tremendous amount of money being spent on package design. And so the second order effects of what you're talking about, if the center aisles go away and you've got robots doing the picking, could be significant.
Well, it will be significant. And you're exactly right that what happened was Now, instead of the clerks being in between the customer and the product, the product was direct access to the customer. And so packaging became very important. And this coincided with the rise of consumer packaged goods. So all of this happened concurrently. It changed the way retail works. It changed the way product marketing worked. And I think there will be secondary effects that customers will now be shopping, doing it. Now, it's important to understand when we talk about micro fulfillment centers today, we're not talking about that automated center store. That is a future. That is a future that we will evolve to. So today we're talking about putting very small automation systems into the store to automate just the online, to automate fulfillment of online orders. And this operates in parallel with a center store that is a self-service store. But in the future, yes, if there is no self-service center store and all packaged goods get sold electronically, get ordered electronically, now the marketing of those products can change. Now how the consumer packaged goods manufacturers communicate with their customers and do the marketing to support those sales, I think will change significantly. And how it could change packaging, it could change how the packaging, there could be two different forms of packaging, the image electronics that people see on the screen, and then the physical packaging doesn't need to be as nearly as fancy, as costly, as bright and vivid. They could save money on packaging because the product's already been sold. It just needs to have a brand recognition. So when they're using it in the home, they recognize the product. But it could have a lot of changes in how products come to market, how supermarkets operate. It will be a transformation. If we achieve this vision of NovaStore, this will be a transformation of retail every bit as complete, as transformative as the self-service model was to clerk service.
Hey, John, can you talk a little bit back to the Alphabot example in Salem, New Hampshire? Are you able to share with us, you know, kind of what you're learning in that installation, and is it truly transforming the how this all works, and is it driving what you were expecting?
Yeah. If you can't pay people to do it, then you have to do it with machines. And we believe that the only way to do that successfully for retailers that have stores is to do it at the store. Because if you create a separate facility, like a dark store or a customer fulfillment center, if you have a centralized fulfillment model for online grocery, then what they're offering is their customers a competing supply chain. So you're saying to the customer, either you can come in to pick your own order, or you can order electronically and we'll pick it in this other facility. And the more customers that you have going to selecting the online, then there'll be a drop in store revenues, right? From the standpoint of the store, this looks exactly like your competitors taking their business away, because in effect it is. It's the competitive supply chain for the same retailer. And eventually, and stores are very highly leveraged. They have a lot of fixed costs and low variable costs. So every 1% drop in sales is probably a multiple percent drop in operating profit. So it won't take much shifting of their business to go online before their stores are not making money. And that cannibalization problem, I think, is fatal for any retailer that has stores that is embracing online, because it's now much more pronounced with COVID, because the acceleration is going faster. So the Financial Times is simply stating what's happening is the shift online is reducing profits because retailers are having to pay people to do what customers normally do for free. And it's going to drive the need for automation much more quickly, because they can't sustain that model, because customers now are going to accelerate their adoption of online grocery. That's going to accelerate the move to automation by retailers in order to achieve a profitable.
I mean, so you can defray the cost other ways. So Instacart, for example, I believe was profitable in Q2, and they're profitable on the back of a performance-based marketing platform that they're running. So they, you know, the picking cost might be a lot, but they're making more money on the advertising to make up for it. So if you're, for example, a Publix doesn't operate their own click and collect program. They use Instacart for that.
But somebody is paying those pickers to pick the groceries. That's coming out of somebody's profit. That's probably, some of that is coming out of public's profit. And those marketing dollars are not going to Instacart without a cost to Publix. They would normally be going to Publix. And so Instacart can be profitable. Publix is a different question of whether they can sustain that model.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. It's like if your customers are on Instacart, then the trade marketing dollars, which are a key part of how the grocers actually, I mean, grocers have almost no margin to begin with.
Right.
So it's like if they lose any of those marketing dollars to an online portal, that's pretty damning for them.
Well, and not to mention the disintermediation to the customer. The customers now consider that they're buying from Instacart, and Publix is simply the back end. So your customer loyalty, your ability to influence the customer is mitigated. We think that that's a very dangerous road for retailers to go down.
Yeah, well, I tend to agree with you. I mean, so I want to get to the economics of this, because to your point, the whole point of micro-fulfillment centers is you've got to reduce the picking costs as much as possible. Right. You got to get them as close to zero as possible in order to make this thing work.
Right.
And I want to just tell a quick story about an Amazon fulfillment center that I visited. And it's germane to a question about your technology. And how differentiated it is from a cost management perspective. So I went to one of the newer Amazon fulfillment centers in New Jersey. And as part of the tour, you see the robot cage where you've got they used to be Kiva robots, but the Amazon robots with the stacks on top of them that they carry around in the stacks.
Yep.
And I asked the tour guide, hey, Amazon always iterates on everything. They must be iterating on fulfillment center design. They're putting up dozens of fulfillment centers all the time. What's the biggest change between this generation of fulfillment center and the last generation of fulfillment center? And the answer they gave me is that the robots were like inches thinner, like 3 inches thinner, 4 inches thinner. I forget the exact amount, but they just made the robots thinner. And by making the robots thinner, it meant that every stack in the warehouse could be 3 or 4 inches taller, which gives the warehouse more storage density, which makes the whole fulfillment center more, significantly more profitable for Amazon to manage, or less costly. They could have more inventory per square foot. And, the essential difference, as far as I understand it, I'm not a micro fulfillment center technology leader here, but in terms of what you guys have built, is you've taken your robots 3D. So Amazon's still doing a 2D game largely with the robots. The robots are moving around the floor and they're lifting up stacks, and so they get a limited third dimension on the stacks.
Right.
Whereas what you guys have built, the robots themselves can move in 3 dimensions, and I would imagine that gives a lot more storage density and storage flexibility. And that's where you get the cost savings from. Am I right over there?
You're exactly right. And the central, in my view, the central limitation in the Kiva tech, what they bought with Kiva, that architecture, is a very inefficient use of vertical space. So they only use about 6 or 7 feet of vertical space for product storage. And then they have the robots moving. So in order to get high density storage, they have to actually build multiple floors in the building. And the improvement in vertical space that you're talking about allowed them to build more floors to get more density in flooring. But that's a very expensive way to achieve storage density. We simply build a steel rack. So our cost of storage is not much more than their cost of storage in a little pod. But we can go floor to ceiling and let the robots climb and access the products directly. But the key differentiation, if you look at shuttle technology, the way shuttle technology works is a linear shuttle, a one-dimensional shuttle, is they have a little robot that's dedicated to each picking lane. So every level of storage in an aisle has a robot in it that simply moves in a line and does the transfers in and out of storage and hands off to a lift. And the lift moves vertically and hands off to conveyors, and the conveyors take it to the workstation, and the mechanisms of the workstation present it to the picker, and then the conveyor, it goes back, right? So what we've done is we've gone to not to a 2D shuttle, but to a 3D shuttle, where the robot does all of the work of the linear robot, plus the work of the lifts, because the robot can turn into a lift, plus the work of the conveyor, because it can move on a floor and go to the workstation, plus the work of the workstation, because the robot directly presents to the picker that does the transfer and it goes back. So what we've done is we've concentrated all of the work of all of those mechanisms in a one-dimensional shuttle system into one robot. And on top of that, what this robot can do, we're working in the lab right now, we'll be testing it early next year, is the ability to deliver the product directly to the customer.
Aren't you afraid and of those robots revolting on you then? I mean,
that's a beautiful thing. Robots don't go on strike. They don't show up late for work. They sometimes get sick. They sometimes, you know, have issues that need to be repaired. But a technician can do that. We don't need medical personnel to do that. And so you get this high reliability, high availability. But the ability of our robot to do all of those things is critically important for making this system small and going in supermarkets. For example, compared to the shuttles, when you build aisles, you have to build throughput, right? If you build storage, you have to have lifts and shuttles to be able to access that storage. When you go inside a store, these systems have been designed to go into warehouses that have tall ceilings and lots of floor space. When you go into a store that has short ceilings and not a lot of short floor space, you have to build multiple aisles to hold the totes that you need to hold. And so when you build those aisles, you build throughput capacity.
If you don't use that throughput capacity,
then you're wasting it. And so one of the things that our architecture does is that it let the storage capacity and the throughput capacity can be sized separately. We can build a storage structure that will last us, be enough to store whatever we're going to be picking 5 to 7 years from now, and then, but only put the robots in that we need to service the immediate demand. So our capital investment can grow over time as the demand grows over time, whereas the shuttle systems today have to put all of that investment in today that's going to be needed 5 years from now.
Nope.
And so that's a critical difference in our system versus theirs.
So we've been talking a lot about grocery so far, and what we're talking about here in terms of the versatility of the system and its ability to go vertical and the ability to play multiple roles. I just am wondering, if you're a manufacturer and you're trying to develop a picking and packing and shipping of each's capability for your own direct-to-consumer strategy, and most of the largest manufacturers that have a large enough assortment where this might be interesting, just honestly just don't have that great a capability around this today. Would a micro-fulfillment center be a reasonable technology investment? Like, you're a Fortune 1000 manufacturer, you want to go D2C. Is this something that they could take advantage of?
Absolutely. I mean, we're having conversations with some of those manufacturers today that want to be on the leading edge of dealing with. So they're interested in both for their own use internally and how it can affect their distribution operations, and also they're interested in it on the impact that it could have in how they deliver products to the retailers in the future as well. So if you're not putting products on the shelf, if they're being picked out of totes, it could have a very significant impact on how they design the products, how they size the products, how they package the products for that distribution.
Can you tell us a little bit, John, about what those impacts might be? Before we get to the Nova Store example, which I think we were talking about earlier, could really change things. But in order for it to work well in this model of the Alphabot, what is it?
I think they're effectively the same thing, because in a supermarket, and a lot has to do with replenishment, is how you replenish the store, the inventory that you are selling, using to fulfill orders, right? The current model of replenishing stores is by case, and that is an essential part of the economics of the store when you have a very large assortment, because the key to mass retail is to have a large assortment so you can appeal to a broad range of personal tastes and preferences in food, but you can't afford to replenish all those inventory locations very frequently because it's very expensive. And so a few of the products are the high velocity products that sell a lot of product, and those turn over very quickly, but the longer tail of the assortment in the store turns over much less frequently and therefore needs less labor for replenishing the shelf. So that's why they replenish by case. For most of the slower moving products, a case can be several weeks, sometimes several months worth of supply, because they don't want to have to touch that pick face, that inventory location, very often to keep their labor costs down. The problem is that you need lots of space. So when we go to automation, we want to make things compact. And the way you can do that is by having a smaller replenishment quantity and replenishing more often, but that requires cost. And what happens with automation is that we can eventually automate that process so that the cost of replenishing more frequently in order to improve density of SKU density in the store becomes much more affordable. And so what I believe will be happening is that over time, and certainly in these early micro-fulfillment centers, we'll be storing products in very small compartments within totes. We'll have multi-SKU totes. I talked about our high-density model. That's at the core of it, is that we can fit as many as 8 different products in one tote location and then pick out of that and then replenish by less in case. We can replenish by each. And so that will have an impact if it drives upstream that of manufacturers sizing their products to fit into specific sizes of compartments within these totes and to be able to replenish these automated picking systems more economically in the right quantity in a package that's designed for a, you know, right now the cases are designed to fit on pallets because that's what how they shipped it. So in the future, stores will be replenished by totes and with totes that can hold multiple SKUs. And so slower moving SKUs will be, I think, will be packaged into smaller quantities that can replenish these picking systems in smaller quantities than is currently done by case.
You know, one implication of the higher density storage model, which is pretty interesting to think about, has to do with the rate of planogram reset that the most grocers have. I mean, so they're not really actively tweaking their assortment on the fly. I mean, they're doing it a couple times a year, right? A few times a year.
Right.
And so the model that you're talking about gives the ability to actually mess with assortment almost in real time as you go. Yep. And I mean, you know, all the contractual details aside and whatever, right? But you know, it gives them at least an ability to mess with the assortment a lot more often than they currently do.
Right.
And it also gives them the ability to more cheaply test out new product lines and just, you know, take small quantities, see if they sell, take new qualities, see if they sell. Some of those test and learn and assortment expansion things that Amazon has done so well in e-commerce and has struggled with Amazon Fresh and other, you know, their other attempts at grocery.
Yep.
I mean, this density model actually gives grocers a chance to succeed at those things.
Well, I think so, and it gives an opportunity. You know, once we get to the ability to automate the complete center store and we can take all that space, we can actually increase the assortment that is offered to customers, and it can be much more dynamic. And so, as you're suggesting, retailers can add products, replace products in the assortment, because it's effectively you get to a level of automation where there's not a lot of human handling involved. So the cost of doing these things can be very low, and your communication to the customer is all electronic. Anyway, so you can add and delete products not by having to remove them and replace them on the shelf, but by updating your website and then changing your distribution of what products get replenished into the pick system. So
this is an absolutely profound change in operation for manufacturers. And I just think I was speaking with the GoPuff team. We've talked to Dan Folkman over there a few times. And GoPuff is competing with convenience. And one of their advantages over like a CVS or a Walgreens or a Duane Reade or whatever is that because they've got a warehouse in the middle of the city, like a Boston or a Philly, they can have every Haagen-Dazs flavor in the warehouse. And you go to a CVS and CVS is limited space, so they can only have a few Haagen-Dazs flavors.
Yep.
And that assortment is a pretty killer advantage from them in that model. But then the flip side of that is from a manufacturer's perspective, if you're managing much more dynamic orders rather than bulk orders that are done upfront with POs and all that sort of stuff to orders that are based on, you know, more dynamic sell-through rate and maybe performance advertising campaigns and stuff like that you're doing, the demand forecasting side becomes a lot more complicated. So there's like a great for consumer, but operationally challenging for manufacturer element that this future makes, brings to the table.
Could be. Yep.
Hey, John, go ahead.
Well, it'll be interesting. All of these things are evolutions, right? So once you start automating, it will start unlocking additional innovations that will drive, additional innovations beyond that. So it becomes a geometric expansion of innovation. I mean, that's what technology does. One technology builds on another in terms of capability and improvement.
Yeah, there's tipping points though. There's like the dose makes the poison. Like, there was a smartphone before the iPhone. It was the BlackBerry, and I had it. It was great. And people used to call them crackberries because you were so addicted to them. They'd pull them out of your pocket and all that sort of stuff. But there was just enough new in the interface in the iPhone, combining the music and the phone in your pocket, where all of a sudden the world changes. It just feels like there's these tipping points where you're building on the shoulders of technical giants, but you just get to a moment where all of a sudden it becomes cheap enough or possible enough or different enough.
Well, absolutely. And I feel a lot of what's going on now in retail is enabled by automation and robots. And if to do this, 10, 15, 20 years ago when I was working on it, it didn't exist. You couldn't be doing it. So it's been all of the evolution in autonomous robots and micro, shrinking electronics and improving software and improving radio communication. All of these things, all of these advances that have been made are enabling, the latest generation of robots to be able to do this. So.
And John, when you're talking to retailers about putting this in, capital expenditures are tough under any circumstances, and this seems like it would be a big one. Do you have a sense of what the return is on this investment, and when does it start to sort of pay itself off?
That's a very complicated answer. The answer is yes, it is capital investment, and it's not trivial when you're talking about putting an automation system into a store. A lot of the estimated return on investment, though, depends on a lot of what you assume about the future, right? So if you assume that the demand for online is going to keep growing, then you sort of have to be, if you want to play in that game, you have to be in the e-commerce business. You have to sell online. And if you're having to sell online, you cannot be profitable by paying people to pick. And so if you measure your return on investment by the labor savings, that will look you will get a good return on investment with a payback of 2 to 3 to 4 years, depending on what you assume for growth rate. But if you assume that if you want to be competitive in the business, and if you don't sell online, you can't compete with the likes of Amazon and Walmart and any pure plays that are out there. If that's what you assume, then the return on investment is the preservation of your business. So how do you value that? So, talking about return on investment, there's the looking at it at a very small level of, I'm going to put an investment in a store. What do I save in labor? What additional sales capacity can I get from that system? And will I be profitable in making that business? We will show a very positive rate of return on that. But then there's also the question of how do I save my enterprise? How do I preserve the value of my company by being able to compete online? What is the return on that investment? What is that aspect of return on investment? And so, it depends on how you look at ROI.
That's what I think is so interesting about the NovaStore idea, is because you're not only transforming the back end, if you will, of it, but that opens up the opportunity to create a new shopping experience.
Absolutely.
And one that increasingly, it would seem to me, leans toward the combining of the digital experience even more integrated into the in-store experience. And so that to me is probably where retailers can get even more excited about the expenditure, because it changes their relationship with the consumer.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. And I believe that's going to start happening with MFCs as well. What will happen with MFCs, I believe, is that now in the near term, it's going to be driven by pandemic fear of going into grocery stores. So there is an artificial repellent to a lot of customers from even going in and selecting their own fresh. They just want the retailer to do everything. But once we have a vaccine, which will hopefully be in the not too distant future, and once we have enough people immunized that we can resume a reasonably normal lifestyle, pre-COVID lifestyle. My belief is that there is an experiential aspect to food retailing, of shopping in the fresh market, of retailers giving a strong customer experience around food in the fresh market, picking your orders on in the center store. To me, is not a very satisfying experience. That's not experiential retail. That's being an unpaid warehouse worker. Yeah. And when robots can do that, customers will now have the choice of whether they want to go in the store or not. My belief is that many of them will want to go in the store because it's enjoyable. They want to pick their own fresh goods. They're interacting with the food, thinking about what they're going to cook and so forth. And they enjoy seeing people. It's a social aspect. So I think that will start happening with the MFC model, where they'll start ordering their packaged goods online and they'll go to the store to pick their own fresh and collect their packaged goods with the order with the fresh order. They won't be necessarily able to order in real time. So I place an order now and it's ready for me in 5 minutes. We may not have that ability at this point, but over time our robots will get that fast and get that good. And at some point, there won't be enough customers walking up and down the center store aisles to make that space worth keeping. And you might as well just automate all the fulfillment for packaged goods and take that center space over and have a large assortment. So at some point, the demand for the ordering online will reach a point where you cannot do it in a small system and have all this unused space in the center store. It'll shift the real estate decision to say, let's just automate the center store and be done with it.
So or you repurpose it, right? So the one of my favorite grocery articles the last few years was longreads.com. It was the man who's going to save the grocery store. And there's a few interesting trends about the center aisle, which are all happening all at the same time. One is trend towards ordering and automation versus picking, which you guys are right at the center of. Another actually has to do with the fresh products in the grocery store, which is there's a bunch of grocery stores that are experimenting with growing products on-prem.
Yep.
They're doing it on the roof and they're just making it so it's like pick to order, right?
Yep.
And you could expand what the fresh section are. Others,
exactly.
You know, famously you've got Eataly and companies like that are doing way more experiential retail with wine tastings and exactly cooking
right.
classes.
That's exactly right. Right. So in a large store where there's a very large center store, we don't need anywhere near that much space. We could have an even larger assortment and compress it into a much smaller area of square footage, and then that frees up that real estate for dining or expanded fresh offering or cooking classes or whatever the retailer chooses to do to attract customers to the store. For me, the importance is that the store has real value to customers, especially in food. That will make not all customers. There will be a lot of customers that will say, I really just want to everything online and pick it up or have it delivered, whichever is more convenient to me. I don't get that much out of going in the store and picking my fresh. But there, a lot of other people, currently more than half of the customers by research, still prefer to pick their own fresh, and I think that's going to return very significantly post-COVID. And from the retailer standpoint, those are going to be your best customers, right? You're going to be able to stimulate additional purchases. It's the lowest cost to serve is to have them come into the store and do their own selection. You're going to have the highest loyalty because they come to your store because they like being in your store. And it's an opportunity for it to have live people, your store associates now engaging those customers and adding value to the shopping trip. So there's all kinds of reasons why retailers will want still to pull customers to the store and why customers will still want to come to the store. Just You can't force them to come to the store, and there will be many that choose not to. And you have to be able to support those that don't.
Yeah, John, I mean, I do think that this is an exciting potential future for grocery and a changing relationship with the consumer, and at the same time, helping with margins. It's just it's a really exciting sector that you're in. And I do have to ask you before we go, have you developed any fondness for your robot overlords? I mean, have you named any?
Robot overlords? The answer is no. They are machines, and that's all they are. It's almost a love-hate relationship, right? Because when they go wrong, you say, "You stupid machine, what are you doing?"
As if it was their fault.
As if it was their fault, right? Exactly.
And well, so it's my old Lost in Space days.
So to me, they're a means to an end. I didn't get into robotics because I was fascinated by robotics. It happened to be that I did find robotics very interesting. But what drew me into robotics was the vision of automating a supermarket. That was why I started inventing in robotics, so I could invent robots that could meet the challenges of automating a center store, which are really daunting. You've got to be extremely fast in how fast you pick the orders because the customers are sitting there waiting. It has to be always reliable. It has to be low in cost a bit so it can, you know, be deployed across many, many locations. They always have to work, right? You can't tell the customer, "Sorry, we can't give you your food today because the robot's broke." So it's a very challenging problem, and it's a fascinating area to be working in, both technologically. I mean, the problems that you have to solve and the team has to work on are very intellectually challenging problems, sometimes, you know, a lot more than you'd like. but it's also a very fascinating area of business, and you're touching so many lives, and the opportunity to transform, you know, how people shop and give people back so many people so much time that they currently spend have historically spent shopping for groceries. It's a very exciting.
Well, John, it's a fascinating story. You know, the passion of an entrepreneur to solve problems like this. It's always exciting, and I can't wait to see how this unfolds. And we'd love to have you back when you've got the full Walmart story that you can share, or the Nova store is starting to come online. We'd love to talk to you more.
Sure, thank you so much. Anytime. Happy to share.
That's our podcast for today. Our D2C strategy playbook series continues. Check out the latest at digitalshelfinstitute.org. In the meantime, please share this episode with your colleagues and friends, or heck, if you love robots as much as we do, leave a review. We appreciate it. Thanks as always for being part of our community.